The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted today to be able to speak to accomplished investor and ex-fund manager, Scott McKenzie. So, big welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Paul. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm a keen fan of your show, and it's an honour to be in such exalted company.
Well, likewise, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on the show, not least given the escalating war in the Middle East. So I don't think we can start anywhere other than that. And how are you approaching the latest sort of like geopolitical turmoil and how it's impacting the markets and sort of long-term investing?
Well, with great difficulty, to be frank, as most of us are. I was actually reading the Rishi Sunak article in The Times yesterday, and he described it as the most dangerous and transformative times in living memory. So I thought it was not a bad summary, actually, of where we are. It feels like a very scary and volatile world, you know, and that makes it an extraordinarily difficult background, you know, to invest sensibly. But, you know, we have to go on with it, really, I suppose. Yeah, in terms of what I've been doing, I mean, my portfolio is predominantly UK mid and small cap, you know, and clearly that's been, you know, hit pretty hard during March. And I think we all had a false sense of security in January. You know, like most people, I had a really good start to the year. February was neither here nor there, and March has been pretty rotten so far. And overall, I think we're down for the year now, having, you know, been quite healthily up in January. So it's been a real challenging first quarter. And yeah, I look back at this decade, you know, the past 6 years has just been chaos, really. It's almost 6 years to the day that we had the first COVID lockdown, you know, and everything that's happened since then has just been unbelievably challenging, you know, and I think you could have made and lost fortunes, you know, during that six-year period. So it doesn't get any easier, I'm afraid, but hopefully we can discuss a few ideas today which, you know, will make some sense to someone.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I think it's a French saying, isn't it? Plus de chance, plus de même chose. And we've just had to say everything, sort of so much change, whether it's been, you know, COVID, the Ukraine, you know, Ukrainian war. We've had, you know, basically we had that with Liz Truss moment. We've had last year, you know, we had the Liberation Day tariffs. I mean, just about every single year we've had a major event. The market, just don't, if you've got to be optimistic, if you're a small and mid-cap manager, you know, sort of like fund manager, or whether you're, you know, investor, etc., you've got to be optimistic about the future, and things do tend to sort of sort themselves out. I do think there's going to be a bit of a cliff edge moment over the next 24 hours, 48 hours, and I think only the brave are going to be investing before what happened, you know, before this end of the 48-hour deadline. And then it's really just see how that progresses. It can go either of two ways. We can have a huge bounce back if it does get resolved or people start sniffing out a resolution, or alternative if it really then does escalates and, you know, Ukraine's basically, so not Ukraine, if Iran decides to actually, you know, really sort of like double down on controlling the Strait of Hormuz, then yeah, we're going to have a bit of a tough spot. But anyway, given you're the first time on the show here, Scott, you know, what's your sort of like approach to investing? How do you sort of like, you know, sort of select stocks and manage your sort of risk profile of the portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, my history when I was a fund manager, you know, which is probably over a 30-year period or so, is predominantly I've always done UK equities. For a large part of my career, I ran equity income funds, you know, when they were still in fashion. And then latterly, I ran small cap funds. So, you know, probably been a bit of a jinx for the small cap market, given the last 5 years haven't been too great. But overall, a mixture of income and small cap has been, you know, my kind of career, if you like. And, you know, I think that stays with me today, really, as a private investor. I did a little piece on my Substack last week about income, you know, and that's a kind of an old love of mine. And you won't be amazed to hear there are lots and lots of, you know, very attractive income stocks at the moment, you're given the falls that we've seen in the markets. So I do kind of go back to those first principles of, you know, it's predominantly a value-based approach, the one that I'm adopting here. You know, I start with a foundation of some income, and then I look for, you know, some really interesting kind of out of favour businesses, really. You know, there are plenty of those at the moment.
Okay, well, let's start off with one of those stocks. Let's go to Ashtead Technology, basically a marine services company. I think two-thirds of the business is in oil and gas, and the other third is in renewables. You'd think it'd do pretty well with a high oil price in this environment, but I do understand it's got about 5 or 6% of its revenues out in the Middle East. I don't know whether that's in the Persian Gulf or whether it's actually more sort of like disparate across the Middle East and whether it's been affected. But how do you see this one going forward? It trades, again, it's a value stock. It trades at about 9 times PE.
Yeah, I know the history of this one quite well. It was one of the few, very successful IPOs, going back 4 or 5 years ago. And it really became a go-go stock very quickly. The first couple of years, the shares, went through the roof. I think they almost trebled in value. And they reached 800p. Today, they're £3.80. So the last 12 months has been pretty challenging for them. I know the business well, and I actually went to visit them in Aberdeen last year, which is where their headquarters are. So it's a very interesting business. It kind of gets tarred with the brush of being a hire company, but there's an awful lot more to it than that. And it's, some of it is fairly sophisticated stuff that they're doing. And it's a global business. People, again, focus on the North Sea, but that's a relatively small part of what they do today. You mentioned the Middle East. They've got a facility and an office in Abu Dhabi. They have some like 25 people there. So clearly that's kind of in the firing line at the moment, so to speak. But it's a very, very global business. They're in Brazil, they're in Guyana, they're in, North America. So really global business. And interestingly enough, a lot of the kit actually gets shipped from the UK. So it's quite a big exporter of kit across the world. So very much a global business. The oil price, there's not a direct correlation with what they do in the oil price, but a higher oil price has to be healthier for them overall, given their customer profile. They're mainly dealing with subsea contractors as opposed to the oil companies directly. But they do have a higher oil price cannot do them any harm, but it may not immediately translate into increased business. If anything, maybe some short-term disruption.
Yeah, and you could see it from the share price, actually. I mean, most of the small cap sector in March has been absolutely hammered. Where actually the shares in Ashtead Technology have been relatively stable, haven't they? I mean, if you actually look at it. So,
yeah.
And obviously, your big oil and gas boys, they're actually seeing appreciation. Mm-hmm. But I think oil and gas services tend to be more of a beta play than the integrated oils, to oil. So I think you're right. I think this would be, overall, if we do have a higher for longer oil price, you'd think that has got to be a tailwind for the company.
I mean, one of the things also in the early part of this year, you see that had a little bounce, January, February time. It was at one point one of the most shorted companies, on the London Stock Exchange, and that's pretty much halved. I think the short was 9%, is now 4% or something like that. And that, kind of is one of the reasons why the shares started to recover. But as you say, they haven't really participated, as the oil majors have done. They've all had dramatic recoveries. For me, there aren't many good oil companies that one can invest in the UK. I think the quality is pretty low by and large, that they're all pretty volatile companies. I think this has got a genuine growth strategy, should serve you well in the long run.
Good, good idea. Okay, let's go to one of the airlines, holiday sort of like Jet 2. This one basically is an airline and a packaged holiday provider. Obviously, it's been hit by the geopolitical turmoil across the Middle East, which has impacted prices of jet fuel. But I imagine they've probably also got a bit of a surge of bookings because people try to front run the price of it. But it hasn't shown up in the share price. It's just gone downhill. How do you see it?
Yeah, this is one that's very much on my subs bench at the moment. Again, it's a business I know really well from my days as a fund manager. And as with Ashtead Tech, I actually went to visit Jet 2 last year in Leeds. It's headquartered in Leeds. You get the feel it's a very, very strong business. It's got a very strong culture, very customer focused. Unfortunately, it's in an inherently volatile sector. And as we're seeing at the moment, you cannot really escape that. To the point you were making a moment ago about biding your time and picking your entry moments in this environment, this is very much one that I've kind of got on my radar screen. It's incredibly cheap for what it is, I think, in terms of the rating, the shares. The track record is outstanding. And I think the evidence of that was post-COVID, when every other airline was falling apart, Jet 2 really sailed through COVID and took enormous market share. you know, it did the right thing for its customers and didn't let anyone down, really. So I think the track record and the brand and the trust aspect is massive here. And if you look at the numbers, you know, the market cap is about 2 billion sterling. Its own definition of cash, which is very conservative, is about 1 billion. You know, so half the market cap is in cash. Return on capital, you know, kind of averaging about 17-18% over the past 3 years, which is quite amazing, you know, for an airline type business. So there's a lot to commend it. Is the short-term trading going to be good? Possibly not. You know, I think it could be a tricky environment. They've made the profit for the year because it's a March year end, and all the money's made in the first half over the summer, so that the current period, you know, has got virtually no profit anyway. So I think they'll find it hard to give a very clear outlook, you know, when they report in a month or two's time. But I think the quality of the business is such, and you know, the margin for error on the share price is now very, very high. So definitely one I've got a close eye on at the moment.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's less than a 6x PE. Do you know how much of their jet fuel they hedge forward at all to give them protection, just roughly?
It's about typically about 2/3 to 75%, I think, over the course of a year. And from memory, it's about 13% of the total costs.
Fuel. Right.
You know, so in theory, that could go up quite materially, you know, if current situation persists. But the hedging's there for a while, and it's the same for EasyJet and Ryanair. They all have, you know, pretty extensive hedging programs. So it's not an immediate short-term issue, but it is obviously something to bear in mind further down the line.
I know this year also they're investing in Gatwick, aren't they? Because I think they just got some slots there. So
they did, yeah. That's actually quite interesting because, you know, Gatwick's a huge airport. I think it's probably the second largest airport in the UK after Heathrow. And it's dominated by EasyJet. You know, and EasyJet have done a terrific job of sewing it up, basically, for the package holiday customer. And EasyJet themselves, you know, are going into holidays in quite a big way now. That's, you know, it's probably 30% of their earnings now come from holidays. Jet2 have been trying to get to Gatwick for many years, and they've now got an initial 6 planes. But to give that some context, I think they've got about 25 planes in Manchester. Yes, it's a foothold into Gatwick, and they will lose money for the first 3 years. That they've been very upfront, you know, with investors about that. But strategically, it's absolutely the right thing for them to do.
Yeah. Good. Okay, let's go to perhaps more than this neck of the woods in the UK. Let's go to Telecom Plus, the sort of an expert in all things utilities. It bundles sort of water bills, electricity bills, broadband together, and sells them all to households through a sort of like quite distinguished direct sales model through its own sort of like local consumer endorsements, etc. Yeah. Shares have done pretty well. Well, so we say they were doing pretty well, and then obviously they've come down a bit this year. How do you see this one going forward, particularly if they're selling energy? How they'd be impacted by a higher oil and gas price?
Yeah, I mean, again, one I know pretty well. I've recently just bought this for my own portfolio, so it is actually in the fund at the moment. You can see here that the shares have been hit pretty hard, you know, in the last 3 or 4 months. In terms of your question about the energy markets, I mean, obviously we have a quarterly, you know, price cap, and that's just been announced, you know, for the next quarter from end of March to end of June or whatever. So obviously there's a lot of press about what will happen, you know, in the light of the current crisis, and there's been a massive escalation in the gas price already in the UK. We're still not anywhere near the levels we were post-Ukraine. And obviously, post-Ukraine, the government did have to do quite a big bailout for a short period of time. I think it's maybe 3 to 6 months. And you know, clearly, the current government's under pressure to do something similar. I don't think we're quite at that stage yet. But you know, time will tell. Well, obviously, we all hope that we can see this current crisis resolved, you know, sooner rather than later, in which case this won't be an issue. But you know, clearly, if it continues, then it will. In terms of the impact in Telecom Plus, the way the company report the results, they tend not to focus on revenue because revenue can be very volatile for that reason. You know, for example, in 2022, revenues went up a lot, but what they tend to focus on is the profit per customer rather than, you know, the absolute margin. So the margin went down a lot in 22, but the actual profit per customer is pretty steady. So that's the key metric here. You made reference to the partnership model, and I think one of the things that has upset the share price, if you look at that big fall, particularly at the end of November, that was when they reported, you know, the interim results for the company. It's a March year end, and those results to be frank, didn't get communicated very well, and you know, led to quite a bear run on the shares. And you can see from the chart that they haven't recovered at all, you know, since that setback. And one of the things that came out there was that you mentioned that, you know, that their partnership structure, which has, you know, been the case for many, many years. More recently, they've been acquiring customers from TalkTalk, and that's a change in strategy. That they hadn't done that before. And whilst it sounds as though it makes quite a lot of sense, I don't think they've explained it particularly well. I think your shareholders were used to this kind of, you know, having these, you know, local punters, you know, selling the products. All of a sudden, they're acquiring, I think it's 200,000 customers from TalkTalk. And these are broadband customers, not energy customers. They've got a long link with TalkTalk because TalkTalk have supplied telephony services to Telecom Plus for many years. And TalkTalk, to be frank, is a little bit financially distressed. So Telecom Plus are acquiring these customers, probably not paying very much for them. Broadband's also a much higher margin business for Telecom Plus than energy is. Energy is a very low margin, you know, regulated business. So if they can convert these customers into energy customers, there's a lot of value for Telecom Plus. But at the moment, shareholders are unconvinced by this strategy, it's fair to say, and time will tell. It's definitely a change, you know, in the modus operandi, and that's upset the share price quite a bit, actually.
Yeah. Is the dividend yield sustainable? Because I'm getting 7.5% dividend yield there.
It's probably almost 8% now, yeah.
Wow.
You're right. Again, if you look at the track record of the dividend here, they've grown the dividend, you know, quite a bit over the years. And their policy is to pay out 80-90% of their earnings as dividend. They're not currently doing any share buybacks. They've done one or two in the past, but share buybacks haven't really been a feature of the capital allocation here. The dividend grew 3% in those recent results. I think if they're sensible, they won't really grow very much from here, you know, because I think they need to convince investors that, you know, they're on the right track with the growth strategy. So I don't expect the dividend to grow much, but I think the 8% should be relatively secure. It's a high recurring revenue business. You know, there shouldn't really be any reason for the cash flow to be under any pressure.
Yeah, good. Okay, all right, let's go to ticketing app Trainline, another one which investors have been pretty sceptical on the actual model of late. But the shares, given all the volatility just recently, have bounced actually by about sort of 10%, which is pretty counterintuitive. What's your thoughts on sort of Trainline, the UK's biggest train ticketing app?
Again, it's one that I bought into, you know, earlier in the year. Touchwood, I think I've actually got a tiny profit in it as we speak.
Yeah.
Not much, it has to be said. You can see from the chart, you know, the shares have been under a lot of pressure again. There's a lot of moving parts here. You know, if you were to come down from Mars and look at the financials, you would say this company's done a brilliant job. You know, it's consistently upgraded its earnings for the last 2 or 3 years, taken huge amounts of market share post-COVID, executed extremely well. You know, they really have done an excellent job. Very high margin business, you know, so they've captured the space. The share price today is telling us that that's not sustainable. And the main reason it's not sustainable is the fact that the railways have been nationalised and they're going to become under GBR. So we go from, I think we have 14 operating companies today to one effectively over the next 2 or 3 years. And that's perceived as an enormous threat to Trainline's business.
And that's Great British Railways, yeah, isn't it, GBR?
Yes, that's right. This has created a lot of turmoil for the Trainline share price. The truth is, none of us really know how this is going to work out, including Trainline. And you know, I always take the slightly sceptical view that if you're allowing the government to produce anything on budget and on time, you can forget it pretty much. You know, and so there are no strict timescales for this. It's supposed to be happening in the next year or two. You know, I would put money on it not executing on time and on budget, you know, given our past experience. So, you know, knocking 14 train companies together is a pretty complex thing to do. And then you've got unions and you've got... And at the end of the day, for the train line business to be, you know, destroyed by GBR, there would have to be enormous public subsidy of the GBR business and its ticketing operation. Your train line gets obviously a fee at the moment for its ticketing. They're hoping it will be a level playing field and that there will still be a retail, you know, market, a normal competitive market. Again, the share price is suggesting that won't be the case. So there's an awful lot of skepticism in the share price.
Because I mean, I suppose the ultimate sort of like downside would be the 4.5% commission that Trainline are currently allowed to charge on their tickets goes to zero because Great British Railway want to keep that profit themselves. I guess would be the absolutely disaster scenario.
Yeah, indeed, but I think that's highly unlikely to happen because, as I referred to there, that would require GBR's ticket operation to run at a massive loss to the taxpayer.
You know, why? Why? I don't understand that.
Because it would be a normal retail business. It would be competing with Trainline. So there'd be a GBR app. At the moment, there are 14 apps, for the different talks, some of which Trainline does already. Basically, GBR would have to have enormous public subsidy for that to work. So as a taxpayer, are you going to be happy with a business which already lose billions, I suspect, for the taxpayer? So it's a tricky one, but none of us have the answers. But I think the balance of probability is that there's a future for Trainline. It's the leading company by a long way. I mean, Uber have tried very hard to get into the train ticketing business and failed miserably. Uber's market cap is 100 times that of Trainline's.
Yes.
And they failed. So I think there's a lot of value in what Trainline do, and I think it's a bit simplistic to think that it'll be completely disrupted overnight. Yeah. There will be challenges. It will be different in 3 years' time than it is today. That's for sure.
Yeah. No, I sorry. The reason why I was just pushing back was that if I bought a ticket which went from London to Scotland, for instance, £200 return, then the 5% that I give to Trainline, the £10, that would cover the expense of setting up your own app. So you wouldn't have to subsidise. You just keep the price the same, but not allow Trainline to sell your tickets, for instance.
The consumer doesn't pay that fee. It comes back to Trainline via the railway industry. So the consumer doesn't pay the 5%. It's just part of the business model. And there are other operators who also sell tickets who get the same fee. Trainline have just got a 5-year deal on their fee. So,
okay.
But there will be a lot of change here. That is something that is undeniable. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I don't know if you got, I don't think you own it or know much about it. We've got Lorenzo just in transport. He's asking about Mobico, which is basically they do the bus and rail operators. They used to have some rail operations in the UK, but I think they've only got buses now. And they had Greyhound, I think, or one of the coach operators.
It's not the old National Express, I think.
Yes, it's old National Express. Yeah, Mobico. I don't know if you've ever had a look at it. I know they've got a big debt on their balance sheet, but I don't know whether you've ever had any other thoughts.
I'm somewhat out of touch with it. I mean, it's a company which has fallen from grace quite dramatically. I mean, I remember National Express back in the day. A credible company. Obviously, Mobico today is a very, very small business, shadow of its former self. As you say, that the debt, I'm aware that they've got lots of debt. For that reason, I've never really looked at it properly. Yeah. So I can't give a strong view. It's one of these highly geared recovery plays, I suspect.
Yeah. No, I would say, Lorenzo, the one thing to watch is look at the interest costs, the covenants, particularly as gilt yields and all types of bond yields go up. So if they have to come to refinance that, it's a lot more expensive at the moment, if anybody gives you money. So there's definitely a bigger refinancing risk on that one. Okay, let's move to sort of house building. We've got Ben Sharman. He's asking about Brickability, which is, I think it's a supplier and distributor of bricks in the UK to all kinds of sort of like tradesmen and house builders and stuff like that. Shares are incredibly cheap at all. What's your view on this one?
Yeah, again, it's one that I've been picking up. I know the company pretty well. They just changed their name to BRCK, so I'm hoping that they did that over a Siamese lunch and didn't pay anyone for that advice. Not the most inspirational name changes, but I think the reason they did it was that the bricks and building materials business is now less than 50% of the profit. So what's happened with BRCK is that they've diversified quite a bit over the past 5 years. The bricks business, as with all bricks businesses, has been struggling. Bricks are in a recession at the moment, and you've seen recent statements from Ibstock and Forterra to that effect. And it's interesting, if you follow those brick companies, if you met them a year ago, they were all talking about recovery and about how their profits would rise dramatically. And that's just not happened. If you look at the building materials kind of subsector in the UK, If you speak to companies like Breedon, you know, the sales of your ready-mix concrete and your cement in the UK are at 60-year lows. You know, so it's an extraordinarily depressed sector as we speak. Obviously, new house building has just, you know, not delivered at all. The government's targets, you know, have proven to be, you know, just hot air, really, and no one believes them. So it's an extraordinarily depressed sector, whether you're in house building or in your construction materials. And Bic Ability is kind of sits between all of that. You know, it does a lot of work with new house builders. It's a distributor. It doesn't do any manufacturing at all. The kind of exciting part of the business and the thing that's really, you know, kept them going is the contracting business, which is basically to do with the safe remedial of cladding. You know, there's a massive crisis, you know, which the house builders are effectively paying for now in terms of, you know, these faulty buildings post Grenfell. And Bic Ability acquired two companies in this industry, which have actually really saved their bacon in recent years. You know, they've been very profitable businesses and to all intents and purposes, strong acquisitions. So that's now pretty much as much profit as the bricks and building part of the business is, you know, from zero 2 or 3 years ago. But one of the issues with those acquisitions is that they're paying earnouts on the acquisition costs. So for that reason, the debt hasn't really come down in Bic Ability, you know, because they're giving the vendors, you know, further payments, but linked to success. So, you know, hopefully that's justifiable. But as you say, the shares, you know, just they keep on falling. P of 4.5, 5, EV EBITDA 3.5, dividend yield 8. You know, it's an extraordinarily depressed share valuation.
Yeah, I know. I own a brickmaker, Michaelmers, and it's the same chart. In terms of Brickability, I mean, I was just looking at the numbers, and it seems as though they have a negative net tangible assets, which seems to imply because of their dropship model. They've got a positive, when they're growing, they get a positive inflow of working capital. But if they're declining in a tough market, that starts to unwind. Is there any sort of like, in a really depressed declining market, is there any risk of a sort of like a liquidity issue on this one as the sales decrease and therefore they have to basically refund their customers in terms of the working capital?
If you look at the history of the cash flow, the working capital hasn't been that material. You get some seasonal biases, so the first half tends to be a bit weaker than the second because they're delivering more stuff. But over the piece, certainly since I followed it, I don't recall there being hugely volatile swings. It is a kind of dropship type operation. They don't hold lots of stock. Mm. So it's not like a builder's merchant. It's nothing like a Travis Perkins, for example, you know, which obviously holds a lot of stock across its network. Bic Ability is really, you know, a distributor as opposed to a merchant. So I'm not aware of that having been an issue in the past, Paul. Obviously, the balance sheet has got a lot of intangibles in it because of acquisitions. They've acquired something like, you know, £150 million worth of companies, which is basically the current market cap, you know, has been acquired over the past 5 or 6 years. So it has been quite acquisitive. Having said that, they haven't done anything really since those cladding deals a couple of years ago. So I think they've been battening down the hatches, you know, more recently.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, just as if they have negative working capital, then naturally as the sales decrease, then you'd get that, you'd have to refund that working capital, wouldn't you, right, as to get you back. But
perception is it's relatively neutral, but I'll check that out now that someone has mentioned it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, one sort of home builder, we've definitely got some liquidity issues, according to the Times, is one of the big boys, Vistry, which used to be the old Bovis, and headed up by a really sort of like rock star CEO, Greg Fitzgerald, who's now sort of like decided to hang up his gloves and move on in a few months, etc. But anyway, these guys are national house builders. Sort of 2/3 of their model is affordable homes and about 1/3 is private. But they seem to have really strong balance sheet optically. But there are questions about that. It's not paying its suppliers. And people are worried, obviously, that whether they lose those suppliers, then lose trade credit finance and there could be liquidity. How do you see this one? I mean, it's a bit of a Marmite stock. It's trading at, you know, really, really sort of like massive discounts to net tangible book.
Yeah, there's a lot of history here. And yeah, when I was an institutional investor, we held it for a while. And to be frank, we got a little bit lucky because they announced this change in strategy a couple of years ago, you know, to move from open market housing to partnerships. and people loved that. You know, that was maybe, I think, summer of 24, 18 months or so ago. And the shares, you know, back then went, if you go back a bit further, you'll see there the big spike at the end of 24. Shares almost doubled, you know. So that, the messaging of that, you know, went down extremely well at the time. I think, you know, the problem here has been terrible execution, really, you know, in a nutshell. You know, they had all these, you know, ridiculously bullish targets, you know, in the summer of 24. You know, they'd have an operating margin of 12, a return on capital of 40. They'd give £1 billion back to shareholders, you know, blah, blah, blah. We sit here today, the operating margin's probably going to struggle to be 8% this year. You know, the return on capital's about 13. And they've done a share buyback, which, you know, to be frank, you know, has destroyed value. You know, so at the moment, you can see from the chart, it's gone, you know, from hero to zero, really. And yeah, I think, you know, the CEO, Greg Fischel, you know, has to be accused of hubris here. You know, he's just been way too bullish consistently. And I think he's alienated quite a lot of UK investors because, you know, there's a very significant US shareholding in this company. And that was something that he was keen to court. You know, as a result, a lot of UK investors don't really trust them. And you can see more recently the collapse in the share price. There's been some short selling, you know, and I think there's maybe 5 or 6% of the company now has been shorted. You made reference to the Sunday Times articles. There's been a couple of articles, and you know, I can't help but think that's related to the shorting as well, you know, and everything just looks pretty ugly at the moment. So I think ultimately it depends if you trust the numbers here. If you trust the numbers, the shares are extraordinarily cheap, and you're buying a market, you know, a leading business in partnership housing, which is going to escalate in importance, you know, absolutely. Industry's the number one player. So if I were Mr. Fitzgerald and I was holding these shares, I think he's got £6 or 7 million of shares, I wouldn't want to end like this. You know, it's with the share price at £3.30, you know, half of the book value. So my guess is they will try and engineer a solution to this problem, you know, and it has to be a company that other people are looking at now, given you're the really strong market position.
Yeah.
But it feels like the darkest hour.
Yeah, if I was just playing sort of devil's advocate on that one, let's just assume there is some semblance of truth in the Sunday Times article, i.e. it hasn't been paid for by the shorters, which is definitely, your point is well made, because these things do tend to go around.
I got no evidence to support that,
I'd thought about that, but yeah, you're exactly right. That's an astute comment. But if there is a semblance of sort of truth behind it, either or short, what could they do in the short term to be able to get over a short, you know, liquidity? And to me, it's difficult to shift land or property. I know they fire sold a shed load of properties in January at about a 10% discount, and they basically had to do that. Now, I think they've shot that bullet and they got a lot of stick for it, and that does sort of like suggest they have a liquidity issue. Now, if they do have a liquidity issue, what can they do other than a placing, basically, which is what the shares are saying?
Yeah, it's a fair question. That, you know, we have to look at what the shares are telling us, don't we? And that's kind of what they're saying. It's hard to know the definitive answer to that. They're clearly selling assets or trying to sell assets, but as you highlight, that's not always immediately possible. I mean, they claim that they've had a very significant upsurge in sales in the year to date, but that comes at a price. You know, it comes at a margin hit. So I think, you know, they're at a stage where they have to get through the next 6 months. It's been a jam tomorrow stock for many years, you know, and there's always the sunny uplands, and you know, there's a £39 billion, you know, affordable housing, you know, boom coming, and industry are the number one player. If you believe that, then the shares are a very clear buy, but the short-term risks you highlight are real.
Yeah.
So it's a very tricky one, very tricky one indeed. You know, it's tempting to nibble at it, but in the current environment, you know, one sits in the sidelines.
Yeah. Oh, just to highlight to investors, I mean, obviously it's a, you know, it is a Marmite. But if they had to do a placing, okay, I'm putting a slider all over what sort of size it would be. They do about 4.5 billion sales, okay, and let's just assume they've been squeezing their suppliers for 30-day terms, and also, you know, like not paying them, and, you know, basically getting forward discounts and this sort of stuff. Let's just assume they needed 30 days working capital, which may be pretty conservative. As in, sorry, it may be too rich, but let's assume they did need 30 days working capital, or that sort of, you know, that sort of number. Then that would be about 300, 350 million on a market cap of about 1.1 billion. So that wouldn't, that sort of chimes, to be perfectly honest. But hey, there's a lot of bad, the point is, as you rightly point out, there's a lot of bad news. And if they don't need to do anything like that, then it's a rock. It's an absolute buyout of, you know, buy of the century.
When the capital employed is £2.5 billion and the market cap's £1 billion. But unfortunately, that capital employed is all land and work in progress. You know, they have to convert that to cash, and that's the challenge at the moment. But if you believe that the partnerships business will become a huge success, then you know, it's a very distressed asset.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move on. We've got another question. We've got George Nick. He's basically asking about Spire Healthcare. I don't know whether you've ever looked at it. UK's hospital. They basically they had a bid process going off. Both private equity interested parties, Bridgepoint and Triton, basically decided not to put a bid in on Friday. And then over the weekend, the board said they were still considering potential offers. Anyway, the market doesn't believe them. It's down. The shares are down 19% this morning. I don't know if you've got any quick comments at all.
Again, a bit like Mobico, it's not really my bag. You know, it's quite a geared situation. I think I seem to recall that the guys from Harvard were talking about it on your show a while back, weren't they? They obviously know it very, very well. It's kind of out with my comfort zone, really. You know, it's not one that I've been following that closely. In theory, it should be a great business, but in reality, it hasn't happened that way, has it?
No. All I would say, George, in terms of the M&A going off, I mean, I own the shares just for sort of like this full disclosure. When I spoke to Stuart Whittleson of Odessian Capital last Monday, he suggested that there might well be other interested parties, which does seem to be the case. The market clearly doesn't believe there's going to be any firm offer, particularly given what's happening currently in the Middle East. The book value, also the market value of the shares, is about 250, 280, something like that, pence per share. But, you know, at the moment, the market's just saying, well, show us your money. Stuart did also say that he had just recently spoken to the management team, who are pretty confident if this does fall through, then they're going to basically take out enough cost to be able to protect their P&L. But don't expect anything of great note at the moment would be a fair reflection, because that's what the shares are saying anyway. It's got the deal.
It's interesting the point you.
Yeah,
I was going to say, Paul, it's interesting the point you make about the asset backing here, because we're seeing this across a number of sectors now. You know, we talked about house building a moment ago, Spire, you look at the property sector. There's a lot of companies now, you know, where they're trading at a fraction of the asset value, or, you know, a significant discount. And that's kind of real bear market stuff. It really is.
Yeah, I know. Okay, well, let's go to another house. Let's go to affordable house builder. We've got MJ Gleeson up in the North and Midlands. They've been sort of like through the mill recently. They're obviously selling off like everything in the house builder sector. They came out with, I think it was a trading update about 2-3 months ago, saying they were seeing some green shoots before the conflict in the Middle East sort of kicked off. But they needed a strong spring season to hit their numbers. Anyway, the shares have continued to fall. How do you see this one? The shares are a massive discount to net tangible.
Yeah, again, the point I was just making, this one, I think, is almost half booked now, you know. You know, the metrics for this company haven't been good. The profit margins have been collapsing. You know, I mean, I can recall a time where this was seen as the most exciting company in the house building sector. You know, it was a real go-go stock. And, you know, the last 2 or 3 years, you know, have been pretty grim, to be frank. And, you know, I think the operating margin in this company is way lower than all the other house builders. You know, it's the smallest quoted house builder by a long way. And the market cap today is, what, 160 million or something? You know, so it's tiny compared to the big boys in the sector. And, you know, they just haven't been able to scale the business, you know, to get the benefits of scale. They sell about 1,700, 1,800 houses a year. They've got this target to get to 3,000, but I don't see any evidence of them getting there. And they've kind of similar to Vistry, I mean, the chief executive of Gleeson was ex-Vistry as well, and he's kind of taken them into, you know, the kind of partnership, kind of, you know, multi-unit type things to, you know, get the working capital down. So not entirely dissimilar, albeit it's less material in the case of Gleeson, but, you know, they've been trying to get the cash in by, you know, doing these bulk deals and by doing more partnership stuff. And ultimately that really impacts the margin. So I think the last margin for Housebuddy here was 4.5%, you know, and it had been 20 in the good days. You know, yeah. So it's come down a long way. The profits are clearly very weak at the moment. Also as a land business, which people have kind of struggled to get their heads around over the years. Basically, it's completely separate from the homes business. Basically, you know, kind of gets planning for land, mainly in the southeast. So completely different business from Gleeson's Northern Territory business. I think from the last time I remember, the capital employed in that business is £40-50 million. You know, if they could realise value from that business, that would be a material positive, you know, for the share price, which is, you know, as I say, market cap 160. I don't know if that's likely or not, but that's one thing I think they could do to realise value. But it's pretty clear that they have to come up with something, because at the moment the numbers are poor and the shares are flat on their back. I mean, I think this is less risky than Vistry and, you know, has potentially quite a lot of upside. It's not ridiculous to think someone could buy Gleeson, because it's a very small market cap and, you know, it's got a niche in affordable housing in the north of England. So someone probably should look at this, I think.
Yeah, and also, I mean, they're a big play, obviously, on first-time buyers, aren't they? So they do cheap homes for, yep, you know, people who just sort of young professionals. So if there's ever another, you know, substitute for Help to Buy, or just interest, if we do start seeing interest, you know, mortgage rates coming down, then they'll do very well. But at the moment, we're not seeing that.
No.
They haven't put another scheme in, and interest rates actually, or mortgage rates are, given what's going off, is, you know, has gone up. But they are extremely cheap for long-term investors.
I think that's the thing with construction in general, that the macro outlook is poor, but the sector's trading at very distressed levels. You know, that's a trade-off you have to make as an investor. Are you willing to take that risk, really? You could be a hero in a few years' time in the sector, but at the moment it feels pretty grim.
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, let's go to one which is less cyclical. We've got hardware and software company in the transport sector. We've got Traxys, which is an old favourite for lots of private investors. Used to be a bit of a darling, and then had had a bit of a hiccup with delays to CP7 spend from network rail, and also has got hit by a sort of like a dearth of CapEx or software spend by the train operating companies ahead of this merger into Great British Rail, because they've got no incentive to spend on that. Anyway, putting all that together, how do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, I know this one quite well, and I've been having a look at it recently. It's quite a small market cap, so I tend not to go much below 100 million personally. This one's about 90 at the moment, so it's kind of at the bottom end of my range. The interesting thing is, you know, the shares have obviously done very poorly in the last couple of years. The overall profits have been kind of static, stable, but they were priced for a lot of growth, hence the derating of the shares. I think they've got a new CEO who came in about 6 months ago, and I think he's kind of kitchen sink the numbers to a degree. You know, they've got virtually no growth in the current year, and given what you're saying about the CP7, etc., that seems sensible to me. Interestingly enough, they've maintained a really healthy cash balance. You know, despite the shares, you know, struggling really badly, the cash is about £25 million on a market cap of 90. So that gives me quite a lot of comfort. You know, it's 30% of the market cap. I think they're doing a small share buyback, or done a small one. And you can see from the chart on the screen that the shares are attempting to have rallies and then falling, you know, and they're not quite getting there. But it feels to me that if they get anything right in this business, there's considerable upside in the share price. So it's one that I do actually think is worthy of some proper attention.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's got secular growth trends in terms of digitization of, say, ticketing and networking and information of the whole sort of the rail sector. And it isn't really cyclical. What it is that we know we have to, you know, invest, and the world needs to invest in its rail infrastructure. And this company is very well placed. It's just its timing when that comes through. I'm with you. I think this is a rock solid business. I don't own the shares, but it's a 10 times P. It just looks too cheap to me.
I agree. And the other point to make is that they had a foray into North America as well, which, again, to be frank, has not been a success. And you know, the previous CEO was very bullish about that, and it's just not worked for them. It's a pretty small business. I think they've only got about 5 million of sales, and the group does about 80 million, but they lose money in North America. They just recently announced, you know, a contract. They've been trying to get various contracts in America, and they finally got one recently. So that could turn the corner. And I think the big thing to consider here is what they do with the cash, really. You know, it's a crucial kind of decision. You know, do we double down in North America, having been unsuccessful so far? And I think the new chief executive's got, you know, some decisions to make with regard to deployment of the cash. But you could see a scenario, if they do something sensible with the cash, that the shares, you know, get a re-rating and, you know, really go to town. So this one, I think, could be quite an exciting recovery point.
Yeah, I think you're right. And if I was in his boots, I'd buy Cordell, because they're basically UK listed, but have their main business is out in the States doing track monitoring. So,
and it's quite small, Cordell, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It'd be just a little sort of, like, you know, tuck-in job. Yeah. Okay, let's go to stay in software. We've got another one which has got secular tailwinds and rock solid balance sheets and recurring revenues. Craneware. These guys do all the software for billing and like CRM, but mainly billing in for hospitals out in the States. They got a bid from Bain Capital about probably this time last year at £26.50, and the shares are less than half now. People worried, obviously, about disintermediation of agentic AI, but there's a lot of bad news in this price at the moment. How do you see this one?
Well, I put it back on my radar screen recently. I hadn't looked at it for quite some time. I used to know it fairly well, but you know, I've kind of stopped following it. And the point you make about the private equity bid, I think, is really, really interesting, isn't it? Yeah, because effectively we have a tentative bid at double the current share price. That's quite an unusual situation to find yourselves in. It's not a distressed company. It got a bit overpriced, I think, you know, for a long time. You know, like many UK tech companies, people tend to go overexcited about them, you know, and they can quite often be on silly valuations because there's a scarcity value in the UK for good tech. And I think Craneware got caught up on that. But, you know, from where we sit today, the valuation looks, you know, very, very sensible indeed. The stuff about AI, ultimately, it's 100% exposed to the US hospital sector. I think it does about 40% of US hospitals with its software. I can't imagine US hospitals are going to be very keen to turn their systems over to AI anytime soon. It's a horribly slow-moving sector. I would imagine that Craneware stuff's pretty well embedded into, you know, the workflows of these hospitals. And, you know, they ain't going to jeopardise that, you know, for the sake of saving a small amount of money, I would think. I don't know enough about this sector, but you know, I just can't see why Trainline would be completely upended by AI, you know, given it's such a regulated, conservative business.
I'm with you. I mean, I think if anything, they're going to be a beneficiary because they're so entrenched within those particular hospitals. Then they're the best place to be able to spin out AI applications and take more of that labor cost out of their hospitals and replace it with software a lot cheaper. So I think they've got a big upsell opportunity there. And, you know, for a software business with nine. They're 87%. So you've got 90% recurring revenue streams and you're growing at nearly 10% per annum organic. I mean, that just, you're going to get huge operating leverage on a 14 times PE. That just looks just nuts to me.
I mean, again, this hasn't been on my list for quite some time. And you see from the chart that, you know, it got unraveled by the AI sell-off in February. You know, the software companies obviously got killed in February. And actually, I did a quick piece in my Substack about, you know, some of the AI stuff that was floating around there. And this, I put this on my list of, you know, stocks to think about. And the shares have just gone down ever since, you know. So at today's price, it looks as though it's a pretty compelling idea, really.
Yeah, no, I would agree. It's a member of the 40% club, I was just saying, actually, because its EBITDA margins are 31% and about 9% top line organic growth, 40%. There you go. So it's one of the few. Let's go to another sort of tech company. We've got Gamma Communications, who I think their sort of modus operandi is they'll go to a corporate and if they want to sort of like have a new communication, new telephony system with broadband and messaging and been able to take all kinds of, you know, different sort of communications in and out the company, then they basically do it for them. The shares, again, have really struggled. I think they moved up from AIM to the main market, which didn't help matters. But having said that, that was some time ago, and the shares, like everybody else, is still going down. How do you say this is incredibly cheap, this business?
Yeah, I mean, this has made the dreaded journey from growth to value. You know, it's never a happy journey to make.
deep value as well.
Yeah, so... it's been fairly incredible how much this business has been derated. You cannot deny the growth has slowed. You know, what people thought was an 8-10% grower is now, I think, only did a couple of percent, you know, in the recent H1 results. Historically, the business has been dominated by the UK and by UK SMEs, you know, particularly. I think that's still about 60% of the business, 20% in your enterprise business in the UK, and then 20% now in Europe and Germany. So the Germany thing is obviously the bull case now in the stock. The UK, you know, to all intents and purposes, looks very mature for Gamma, and obviously it's 80%, you know, of the revenues. They acquired several businesses in Germany over the past 2 years, and those, I think those have largely been done for cash, if my memory serves me correctly. And the interesting thing about those are that they are, it's a very under-penetrated market. It's also a much higher margin business than Gamma's UK business. So, you know, if they can grow it rapidly at a much higher margin, then this is probably something that could really turn the share price around in Gamma. I think they've got results tomorrow or the day after as well. But they're doing a large share buyback, you know, and this is a theme at the moment as well. You know, a lot of these companies that we're discussing today are doing share buybacks, and Gamma is one of those. And I think they put out a statement in January saying they're going to be doing 85 million over 2 years, you know, in the market caps, 750 or something. You know, so it's not insubstantial what they're doing there. So I think, again, that the shares just look crazily oversold.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking at they're trading at roughly around about about 9x PE, 2.5 yes. time, 2.5 dividend yield, etc.
Yeah.
And they should have a fairly stable revenue stream. I guess where is the growth coming? Is it basically geographical expansion? Is the idea? Because it isn't new, is it? Digital telephony has been around for. I mean, BT have been doing it for ages. Mm. They slipped up with their global managed services doing this exact thing years ago.
That's right. No, I think that's the issue, that hitherto the UK had been growing pretty steadily. I think, you know, 5-7%. Now the UK is growing at 1 or 2. You know, so there's been a significant slowdown in the UK. You know, more SMEs are coming under the cosh, looking at, you know, how they cut their costs, etc. You know, I'm being somewhat simplistic here, but also you've got the copper wires are, you know, being phased out, and so in theory they've got a chance to capture some of this fibre business, but that tends to be a lower margin as well. You know, so the margin's under a little bit of pressure in the UK, and the growth has slowed quite a bit. So I think, you know, what I was saying previously about Germany, I think that's crucial to the rehabilitation of the share price here. If they can really, you know, knock it out of the park in Germany in the next few years, then the shares will recover. As it stands, I think there's a very significant margin for error on the valuation. You know, in terms of the PE, EV, EBITDA, recurring revenue, as you say, is well north of 90% here. So I don't see this as a massively risky business. Yeah. It's just gone ex growth a little bit, and the shares have suffered as a result. But I don't feel as though it's a terribly risky proposition in the current market environment.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Okay, good. Let's stay in the tech sector, but go into sort of the cosmetic skin treatment. Let's go. A new IPO. We've got Beauty Tech Group. I think they IPO'd the back end of last year pretty successfully, actually. These guys do at-home sort of like laser and ultrasound sort of treatments that you put these face masks on, and then it sort of helps and beautifies yourself. So I've been using it, obviously, a lot. No. but anyway, the shares are down 8% this morning, I guess just because it's thin liquidity. But any quick thoughts on our beauty tech?
Well, I do have a story to tell here that I have a small holding in this company.
Okay.
Which wouldn't be my natural habitat. I did buy it post the IPO. You know, it went to a discount originally, as you can see from your chart there. It went, you know, went down initially, and then had a really strong surge, and now it's gone down again. So you know, we're still underwater. I think the IPO was done at 270, you know, so it's been very weak in the last month or so. As you kind of alluded to, it's quite illiquid. The free float is only about 33%, you know, so the founders and, you know, those guys still have, you know, pretty significant stakes. To my knowledge, it doesn't have any big private equity overhang. You know, normally a problem with these IPOs is that you have a huge private equity stake, which is an overhang, and that's been a problem for many IPOs in recent years. I don't think that's the case here. And really what's happened since the IPO, surprisingly, they've upgraded the numbers twice in 3 months, which is quite unusual for an IPO. Normally you get the opposite problem where they're floated on these ridiculously bullish numbers and they go up in a puff of smoke. This one has done the opposite. It's had two upgrades. Their numbers have gone up maybe 18-20% since the IPO, which is quite something. My background to this was that I got my wife to check this one out because clearly I didn't feel as though I was their core customer, unless they're offering plastic surgery, perhaps. But and she checked it out and did all the research for me, and it's a credible product. You know, it's sold predominantly via influencers and you know, beauty salons, etc. It's a very global business. You know, I thought it'd just be in the UK, but actually it's only 20% UK, 80% rest of the world. And it's a pretty decent margin company. You know, the margins are 22-23%. So it's potentially a growth stock.
Yeah.
Trading at a very low price. You know, so I think the PE today is about 11 times. You know, on the numbers for the current year. And you know, this could grow easily 10-15% per annum for the next 5 years. I think the big question in the longer run is it a fad? You know, that's I can't answer that question. I think it could do very well over the next 3 to 5 years, but you know, will the bubble burst eventually? I don't know.
Yeah, that would be. It'd be sort of what is the sort of the USP for this, the defensive moat? Because is it going to be a sort of ninja shark throat Dyson type, where it's got longevity and a really strong brand, and then it can put in multiple products, or is this going to be a sort of a one trick pony? And have its product? I mean, basically, I don't think it's new technology. I think it's lifted and shifted existing sort of like, you know, beauty salon type treatments into the home and made it affordable and attractive and for influencers. So what is the USP on it there, Scott? Do you know?
But the one thing that I wasn't aware of until I looked at it was you require FDA clearance for these products. You know, they go through quite rigorous testing. They work with Manchester University and do all the testing. And interestingly enough, I believe that L'Oreal are about to launch a product, you know, a mask type product, which you would think is very bad news for beauty tech. But L'Oreal has said pretty much it'll take them a year to get to launch. So there's quite a rigorous process, you know, in terms of the LEDs in the product. The FDA have to approve it. So it's a much more rigorous process than I would have thought, you know, when I first started looking at it. I mean, when you go onto Amazon and Google, you will find really cheap masks, but they're not obviously tested to any degree. So there is a low end of the market, which is there. The beauty tech product is called Current Body. It's quite high end. It's, you know, it's 400 quid a ticket. So it's not a cheap purchase. I know because I bought my wife one for Christmas. But she loves it. I think it could do really well in the next couple of years. I don't know if it's got a moat in 3 to 5 years' time, you know, to be frank. But you're not paying for that anyway, I don't think.
Okay, good. Right, let's go to the price comparison website, Money Supermarket or Moni. This is really has been a sort of like a Marmite stock, sort of like some people love it, others don't. Its modus operandum, obviously, is acting as the in-between for consumers to help them find the best offers to meet their requirements to do like maybe travel insurance, energy bills, financial products, all kinds of subscriptions, which are quite complex sort of like purchases Anyway, the big question is it going to be ever disintermediated or impacted by agentic AI, which is where the bears are hitting? Yeah. Obviously, how do you see it anyway?
Well, I have been dabbling in this one, and yeah, it's a little bit of a quandary because, you know, on the surface, it's an extraordinarily lowly valued company for what it is based on what it's achieved so far. A bit like Trainline, the share price is suggesting that the future is going to be fairly grim. They had results recently, so reasonably up to speed in this one. And you know, the one of the problems I've had is actually Google itself. You know, at the moment, all the price comparison websites rely on Google's pay-per-click, and the cost of that have been going through the roof. So the bigger question for me is there are four PCWs in the UK at the moment, you know, Go Compare Money, Confused, and Compare the Market. You know, so there's four of them slugging it out, doing pretty similar things.
Just on that one, Scott, why is the cost per click for Google going up? I mean, I think I know why, but I'm sure investors would be, because it's going to impact lots of other stocks as well.
It's a monopoly, and they do it because they can. And the problem is they've got these four guys slugging it out with each other. You know, so the story for Money would be infinitely better if there's only two or three PCWs, but there are four. You know, and that's inherently not very helpful because they're all fighting each other and paying Google ever more money, you know, for the pleasure. So if you look at Money's results, the gross margin went down because Google are killing them, basically. Interesting enough, the net margin they kept pretty stable because they're cutting their costs. And I think they've already seen some benefit from bringing AI into their business and cutting their own operating costs. And you know, I think that's something that could apply to Trainline as well down the line, where you've got all these data scientists that you're employing, who are not cheap, and all of a sudden you could reduce your cost base quite a bit using AI to replace people effectively. Yeah. So I think it's a double-edged sword, the AI thing.
Yeah, I'd heard actually on the cost per click, the reason why it's going up is because of agentic AI like Gemini 3. They put those answers now at the top of the blue links, and therefore the amount of inventory available to bid on has decreased. And if you look at Google's results, what's been very surprising over the last 2 years is that actually their sales line for search has gone up, but their volume of traffic has gone down. Just the price has gone up as people have had to bid on a smaller, shrinking inventory of blue links, which is, as you say, is detrimental to all the price comparison websites and probably
that makes sense.
As well.
And I mean, another company who talk about this are Victorian Plumbing, who again are a 100% online retailer, and they talk about Google in a similar vein to Money. You know, Google is just, you know, kind of extracting its pound of flesh from online players. So I think that's the challenge. And you know, I don't know if you saw with the Money results, they announced a tie-up with ChatGPT, and they're trying to embed their product in ChatGPT. As far as I know, they're the first of the four PCWs to do it, but ultimately they will all do it, I suspect. So it's going to be interesting how those dynamics change. You know, is ChatGPT going to compete with Google for this traffic? You know, what is their modus operandi? We don't really know what ChatGPT are trying to do, but we do know that it's a regulated business. These are FCA-regulated companies. You know, insurance is an FCA regulated market. So, the ChatGPT want to get involved with regulation? I'm not sure.
Yeah, and you've also got these new agentic AI apps like Insurify out in the States, who are doing essentially price comparison just through AI, agentic AI, for, you know, basically travel insurance, home insurance, and all this sort of stuff. And the worry is that you get more suppliers of these services who can just spin it up basically on it.
But, well, I looked at Insurify, and it's actually not new. I think it's been around for about 10 years, as far as I'm aware, in the US. And again, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think the PCW market really exists in the US. You know, so Insurify are doing something relatively innovative in the US, but obviously in the UK we have a very established four-person market. As far as I know, Insurify haven't made any intentions of moving into the UK, but that could change. We don't know.
Okay.
At the moment, they haven't done it.
Okay, good. Okay, well, let's go to Pets at Home Retail. They've got sort of two arms to it. They've got a vets practice business that's done very well, and then they've had this pets retail business that has been struggling, and I think they've replaced their CEO of late, who's now got a turnaround strategy. How do you see this one?
Yeah, I mean, I've not really had much exposure to retail recently, but it's a sector I know quite well. And I think the way to do well retail is to identify turnarounds, you know, because most retailers over the cycle don't do that well. And, you know, quite often they'll have a few good years and then they'll crash and burn. I'd say probably only Next has been, you know, a consistently outstanding retailer in the UK. So at any given time, there are recovery stops. You know, so in the last couple of years, we've had the likes of Currys and the likes of Marks and Spencers. You know, been great recovery investments for people. And Pets is kind of the opposite of that at the moment. but it caught my eye because, as you alluded to, it's got one really good business and one pretty terrible business. And I do think they made a bit of a mess of the core business, if I'm being frank. You know, the stores, you know, post-COVID, you know, they enjoyed a boom like many people did, and they just didn't capitalise, you know, on that advantage. And if you look at the recent results, I think that the operating margin in the retail business is now kind of 2 or 3%. You know, it's really pretty terrible for what should be a market-leading business. They have 460 stores. The vets business, by contrast, has gone from strength to strength, you know, over the past 3 or 4 years, and such that if you look at the first half profits for Pets, I mean, I was amazed by this, but 90% of the profit came from vets and 10% came from retail. You know, it's completely changed. So I think, you know, there's potentially a turnaround story here. The new chief executive is just about to start, and I think he came from Waitrose. And they've also got a new CFO, again, just starting at the moment. So there's quite a lot of management change here. Now, I don't know if they'll do, you know, the classic kitchen sink, you know, the next set of results. There's probably a chance they'll cut the dividend, I would have thought, because the dividend's 7.5% yield. They're doing a share buyback as well, incidentally. So a lot to consider here. But I just think in the retail sector, if you can find turnaround stories, quite often they can be quite exciting, and this just strikes me as one which is completely flat on its back and has got new management coming in and could get interesting, really.
Do you think they'll ever sell the retail business at all? Because they don't have a really kind of high value, well respected just pet vet practice.
They can't, because 70% of the vets are in store. So it's vertically integrated. It's not like CVS, who are a standalone vets business. You know, the vets are embedded in the stores, so I don't think there's a sum of the parts argument here at all. You know, I think they need to make the stores better, basically, is the challenge, really, and more profitable. You know, obviously there's been a lot of competition. I think they've been a bit complacent. You've got Amazon, you've got, you know, any number of online players, you've got Tesco, B&M, all these guys who've been eating their lunch, so to speak. So they have to fix the core retail business, I think, is the key to it here, really.
Good. Okay, well, let's stay in the sort of retail, but retail tech. Let's go to PayPoint. These guys basically do help people do payments in store, in convenience stores, like the sort of power bills, energy bills, and also they do they've got an e-commerce sort of like business where people can drop off parcels and pick them up, etc. They need to deal with the post office just recently. Plus, they own, I think it's a gift card business and a sort of like a hamper, Christmas hamper business. They're one of the few stocks that are up this year. They're up 20%. That is just incredible. So a big hat tip to PayPoint. And is the momentum turning on this one?
Well, I can confirm it's the only stock I own that's up this year as well. So that's a result. We should be thankful for that, shouldn't we, really? And so, you know, this is a stock that I dabbled in at the beginning of the year, and it's, you know, it's gone up a little bit and obviously fallen away more recently with everything else. It's a bit of an oddball, really, PayPoint. You know, it's a fairly unique business in terms of the quoted market. It's not always the easiest company to understand. You know, it's suffered a lot over the years from investors. It's too difficult, you know, to understand. And, you know, investors just say, well, I can't be bothered with this one, really. You know, so as a result, it tends to trade at a very low value. You can see that from the chart that, you know, towards the end of last year, it actually had been doing okay for a couple of years. And then you see that there was a big wobble in the share price kind of late November, early December. They had results and they had a target. I think the EBITDA target was 100 million and they said it was going to be 95. So they were 5% short and the shares got clobbered. And I think it was that point where people just don't always really understand what's going on here, you know, because it's got these four different divisions. But if you take a step back from it, it's, as I say, it's a unique business. You know, it's got the network of tens of thousands of these stores with the terminals. That's a fantastic recurring revenue business, extraordinarily high margin. And what they've done is, you know, try and add more services. You made reference to parcels there. That's a really high growth part of PayPoint. And, you know, the Royal Mail now own 49% of what's called Collect Plus, the parcels business. And if you go into any of your local stores, you'll see that they're engulfed with people dropping off parcels and picking up parcels. And, you know, I know this myself from my own store locally, that, you know, that there's parcels are a big business for these small stores now, and PayPoint are right at the vanguard of that. And now they've got the Royal Mail involved as well. The other thing that they're growing is banking. You know, again, bank branches have been closed, you know, been closing for decades. So they've got to deal with Lloyds, you know, to do banking services for Lloyds. They're also benefiting from the post office, you know, the decline in the post office, which is really struggling. So there's a couple of growth engines. And then you've got other things such as the Love to Shop business, which, to be frank, I don't really know why they bought that. It's a bit of a weird thing, you know, and doesn't help.
It's a gift card business, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's also a Christmas savings business, and yeah, you know, that's the bit that people struggle with, really, myself included. And I think it detracts from, you know, some of the things I was just talking about. But if you add it all up, the shares are extraordinarily cheap. They've also got a shareholder, a Spanish shareholder, owns 32% of the company, which is, again, quite odd. I would think this is likely to be a take private company. You know, it was one of the reasons I bought it. I couldn't see much downside in the valuation. They've got a high dividend yield. They're doing a huge share buyback. And I think they will ultimately go private as my thesis there.
Yeah, I did actually speak to the Harwood boys, and they own it, and I think they've got the same view. At some point in time, it's going to be bought by somebody else who's going to unbundle it. So they're pretty experts. Okay, let's move to sort of like restructuring expert FRP advisory. Now, if the economy is going to hell in a handbasket, you know, sort of stuff, absolutely disaster, then these guys should do really well helping people with insolvencies and administrations. I think they're really well respected in the UK as well, because they get appointed a lot for companies which go bust. The shares have just, they've just obviously gone south like everything else, which looks like a good opportunity to have a really good look at it. How do you see it anyway?
Yeah, I think it's genuinely daft, the share price. And I don't own it at the moment, so I'm absolutely not talking my own book here. But I do know it very well. I've followed it since the IPO. I think they're very, very sensible guys. You know, they've consistently delivered in the 6 years since the IPO. I think, you know, the compound growth's about 12% per annum. It was slower in the first half this year. I think the revenues are up about 5%. The dividend grows every year as well, so you've got a kind of P/9 yield of 5.5 type stock here with really credible management. And I'm struggling to work out why it's been so poor recently, other than general small cap malaise, because it's a very counter-cyclical business. And let's face it, we don't exactly have a healthy economy in the UK, and it's deteriorating by the day. So this should be a beneficiary as a counter-cyclical business, and it's behaving as, you know, every other small cap. So I kind of struggle with why the shares have been so weak. And it's severely tempting, you know, to look at it now at the current price.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it from the start of 26, it's down 25%, isn't it? So, yeah. if the economy is that bad, then these guys should be up 25%, not down 25%.
I'd be amazed if this lot have a profit warning, you know, whereas other stocks that we've discussed, you know, I've got earnings risk. There's no doubt there's earnings risk around, but I don't really see it in FRP. So it's one that I'm very tempted by, you know, having watch the decline in the share price. And I think it's a relatively, again, a bit like the Gamma comment, I think it's a relatively safe company. I don't feel as though you're about to get a horrible shock when you buy this one. So that for me has gone up my list of to-dos, really, yeah.
Okay, well, let's go to some of the asset managers, something you know very, very well. Let's go to start with Mercia Asset Management. These guys are all experts in all things sort of venture capital finance for small businesses in the UK, particularly anything outside of the southeast. Now, I think they run a lot of money for other investors, about 2 billion, but also have their own investments that home to get some realization. And I did notice last week that they raised an extra £80 million for some of their VCT funds, largely on the back of the VCT tax change, which is happening in April. And I think people were front-running the benefits of the tax. Anyway, putting all that together, the shares have done absolutely nothing. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Again, it's a new holding for me, but I knew it from my days as a fund manager. It's relatively small. I think the market cap's about 120, but they have a pretty healthy cash balance. Again, the balance sheet really strong, 35 million of cash. You know, so you're getting an 85 million enterprise value there. They're also doing a small share buyback. It's kind of a bit of a token effort, but nevertheless, it's there. And again, there's a kind of asset story here. The published NAV per share is 43p, but if you take out, you know, goodwill and intangibles, it's probably about 34, 35p. So still trading at a discount. But the interesting thing here is they've been building up an asset management business, which is now becoming quite profitable. You're correct in what you say, Paul, that they've got about 1.8 billion of third-party manager funds. And that is a really healthy revenue margin. It's about 2% roughly, so way in excess of, you know, most other fund managers, reflecting the kind of specialist nature. The other part of the story is their own balance sheet. So they have about £130 million worth of on-balance sheet investments. And this is the bit that people feel a bit uncomfortable about, because they have a target to realise 80 million of that 130, and to date they've done precisely zero. So there's an element of show me here. The management have laid out their stall that they will do this in the next year or two, but so far there's been no progress. And these are clearly, you know, early stage assets. They're not always easy to sell. You know, a lot of them are just coming into profit. So that's the kind of the bear argument, is that they've got these balance sheet assets that they can't sell. That's the bear argument. Should they achieve those sales, I think the shares will perform very strongly indeed. And it's the margin for error again at 27p, I think, is extremely high in the share price.
This is sort of, I mean, I don't know whether there's an opportunity here, but clearly they've raised a lot of money from their third-party investors. As long as there's Chinese walls and transparency and proper investment, then they've got a portfolio that they need to realise. And then you've also got, as long as it was done on independent sale, then you've got funds, theirs and other people's, who are looking to deploy capital in early stage companies. It just seems as though if there's a lot of money going into VCT trusts, theirs and other people's, then you would think there's an opportunity to sell some of those into yours and to other people's VCT, you know, capital funds. But
That's possible. And you know, I think you know, it's interesting also, if you look at, you know, the kind of the whole debate about pension fund investing in the UK. Obviously, we've got all these mansion house compacts. You mentioned the British Business Bank, who are a very big customer of Mercer's. You know, that's one of their key clients, is British Business Bank. You know, and if you believe what all these people are saying, there's going to be more money getting into private assets, not less. I don't think there's much in the Mercer share price for that, you know, and I think they could have a strong organic growth in their assets under management. You know, they're already doing quite well in VCTs. They could get a lot more, you know, venture capital from these other sources. So I can see a scenario where the assets grow quite healthily and the operational gearing on those assets is very high, because the fund management business then becomes extremely profitable, and you almost get the fund management business for nothing here. You know, because you've got the balance sheet covering the market cap. So one way or another, it has to resolve itself. And if they can do a semi-decent job, you know, I can see the shares going up 50-100% from here.
I would agree. Good. Okay, let's go to another fund manager. It's something we don't talk about very often. We've got Brooks Macdonald. I think these guys basically invest money which is placed to them through IFAs. Anyway, the shares of, like all the fund managers, have been absolutely hammered, actually, this year. They're down about another 20-25%.
Yeah, that's, again, it's one I've known for a long time. There's been a lot of change going on here over the past 2 years. That they've brought in a new chief executive who's changed most of the senior management, new CFO, new head of marketing, distribution. You know, so there's been quite a big change in the management. and also some change in the business as well. They had an offshore business in, I think it was the Channel Islands or the Isle of Man. They sold that, and they've been buying financial advice businesses with the money. So there's been quite a change in the approach. I mean, historically, I've kind of perceived it as quite a sleepy company. You know, it was trundling along, doing okay. It's a medium-sized wealth manager. And obviously in an industry where the big boys are getting larger all the time, you've got Rathbones and Investec. You've got RBS buying Evelyn recently. So there's huge consolidation amongst wealth managers, and Brooks is a kind of middle-sized player. And my criticism would be, is it doing anything special? Hitherto, not really. You know, it's been a fairly me too type offering. They've done pretty well in the MPS business in terms of, you know, expanding that managed portfolio service. But you know, the gold standard there really is Tatton, who you've been extremely successful in that business. So lots of change going on at Brooks, and you've not yet seen it in the numbers. The shares are quite depressed, lowly valued. They've got a target of bringing in 5% of AUM each year, which equates to about £800 million per annum. They've stopped the outflows. The recent results, they had basically zero in and out. Can they deliver this asset growth? It is the question. If they can, the shares are materially undervalued.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, they probably need to be, they'll probably be taken out at some point in time.
We've been saying that for a few years and it hasn't happened, but it could well do now, because it's a cleaner business and a better business than it was potentially. And interestingly enough, you know, I mentioned Evelyn there, but there's been a lot of private equity transactions in wealth management, and they're all materially higher multiples than the ones in the public markets. You know, Brooks Macdonald and Rathbones are, you know, the two probably best known public market examples, but you know, they trade on much lower valuations than the private equity guys do. So I think that's quite interesting as well.
Yeah, I think you had Lion Trust, was it 2 weeks ago or last week? Took out River Capital, River Global. That's right. Which is the old River and Mercantile business. So, yeah, I mean, it took the other one, which will be taken out, is probably Premier Miton.
it's very small now, again. It has a huge amount of cash in its balance sheet.
Yeah.
It's interesting, you mentioned those companies, even the likes of Lion Trust, Premier Miton, and Impax, you know, have all been terrible performers. Mm. They've all had massive amount of cash, but so far it hasn't really done them any good, unfortunately. They're just a bigger part of the market cap now than they were 3 or 4 years ago. But these companies, most of those should just go private, because the returns they'd make as private businesses, you know, are probably infinitely better than they are being quoted. But that's another debate, I suppose.
Yeah, we've got one final question. Carcosa is asking about, I think the company came out with results, specialist lender, depositor, distribution, finance, capital. I think it IPO'd a few years ago during the boom of the of 2021. These guys do lending to things like dealers, so caravans, motorhomes, sort of like niche motorcycles, a bit of agricultural equipment. I think they do marine equipment, like your powerboat up there in one of your sort of locks up in Scotland. Anyway, the shares surprisingly have done very, very well. They came out, I think the results are slightly today. I don't know if you've got any quick thoughts on this one at all.
Again, Paul's not one I really know well. It's kind of on the smallish side, isn't it? As you say, the shares have recovered quite nicely. But no, it's not one I've properly looked at. I mean, obviously, we've had a lot of kind of shenanigans with Close Brothers and their, you know, their kind of asset finance business. You know, that's had a fairly checkered few years. But this one seems to have done much better, doesn't it?
I mean, I don't know much about it, Carcosa. All I would say is that I think from sort of like my memory, I think the net tangible assets is roughly around about 74-75p compared to a sort of like a share price of 54. You'd have to check that, because that's just off the top of my head. So there's still a significant discount, even though the shares have done very well. One of the fund managers I speak to, Richard Penny, saw this one about 3 years ago and been banging the table on it, telling me it's his stock pick and he's done very well out of it because basically they've got a critical mass and economies of scale in very niche lending areas. Because I mean, you know, motorhomes and caravans and specialist dealers and stuff need finance, and I think they make a net interest margin, if I remember rightly, of about 8%, which looks sustainable because they have deposits which cover their lending book, and therefore, you know, they can have got a stable sort of like, you know, deposit book, so consequently they're not getting wholesale interest rates on their input. So I like it. I think it's a good business. I don't own it, but Looking at the share price, I would stick with it anyway, but that would be me. Okay, we've got one, and I can't believe if it's right. Lorenzo's saying Goodwin, which is the specialist engineering business with sort of defensive property. He's got defense and stuff. He says the shares are down 38% today. I mean, if that's right, I haven't seen any news on it. I don't know if you've got any quick thoughts on Goodwin at all.
Well, it appears that the shares are down 38% because they've had a trading update today.
Oh, have they? Oh, yes. Wow.
So it does appear as though they may have had a small profit warning.
But, yeah, okay, a small one. Yeah, okay, right.
But
okay,
it's something to do with the Middle East, apparently. I mean, this is obviously a stock that a lot of private investors know pretty well, don't they? I'm less up to speed with it, I must confess. But yeah, it's been an amazing go-go stock, hasn't it, for quite a few years now.
Yeah, all I would say, Lorenzo, is if that, you know, it looks obvious, it is, it's 40% down on a trading, but I'll probably speak with Paul Scott on Wednesday. But where you get essentially a very crowded trade and it's highly valued in very good secular long-term trends, then when you do get a hiccup and any bad news, you get a whole lot of people who just automatically hit the sell button, which is what's happening in a very down market with no buyers at the moment. So you're going to struggle to find a floor on it. If anything, I would actually look at this as potentially let it settle out, let it bottom, and look at it as a potential entry point going forward for a very, very high quality business. But that does seem something that is, a lot of investors, I think, would be very, very annoyed, I think, about going in on that. But hey ho.
It's kind of the danger of momentum investing, isn't it? That's one of the issues where you don't have the margin for error because people love something so much already.
Yeah. Well, I can't believe it. We were getting to nearly 90 minutes. Wow. It's been fantastic here, Scott. So I am going to actually push you for one last your favourite stock idea for the next 12 months. You've done an absolutely sterling job there in Scotland. So
it's easy to find buys today, isn't it, when everything's the battlefield is kind of full of injured soldiers. I think one stock that I do own, which had results last week, which I've seen, I think might be an interesting one. I think it's important in the current environment try and find stocks that aren't impacted by all the madness that's going on. You know, and the stock that I'd probably highlight to viewers is IP Group, which is the kind of healthcare trust. And that's one that I know very well and I've got a holding in. And the reason I highlight it is that it's just had results and it's had, you know, some quite interesting positive developments there. Again, it's an asset play. The NAV just publishes 110p and the share price is 50 or 49 after today. And, you know, we've just had a bang up to date update from them. If people are interested in this, they did a very good chat on the Investor Meet Forum as well, you know, last week, which I listened to. And the basic thing here is they're involved in healthcare, kind of med tech, you know, deep tech, queen tech type things. I don't, from what I understand, see any issues with AI in their key investments. And, you know, also they're not obviously affected by the current geopolitical events as well. So I think for a stock which is trading on a very, very large discount, it's doing an enormous share buyback, or has done, and it's about to do another. That for me looks like something that's extremely mispriced, but again, shouldn't have an enormously high risk profile. So that's probably one I would leave you with, is worthy of doing some more work on.
No, great idea. I mean, if you're right, it's protected basically or insulated by all its IPR in life sciences and healthcare, and therefore shouldn't be a cyclical play. It should be a secular growth play. Worth having a look at. In fact, I'll have a look at that. All right.
An explanation of the deal they've done with Pfizer as well, with royalties, which is the real bull part of the story. So they explain it on the Investor Week meet thing. So I would highlight that as well. It's been a major new development for them. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, okay. Well, thanks very much, Scott. Thanks, everyone, for your questions. I'm going to go back and get my tin hat on because my portfolio is getting absolutely annihilated. Are you going to go back in the trenches there, Scott?
Yeah, so I have a small crying. I've been hoarding a little bit of cash, but yeah, we're getting closer to deploying it, I think.
Yeah, well, in fact, you could probably strum a few, get those guitars going in the background and strum a few tunes for everybody to live and mass us up, because I think it is definitely going to be tough conditions over the next 48 hours until we know what's happening out in the Middle East. But thanks again, Scott. Absolutely fascinating.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And look forward to touching base, hopefully, in the next six months.
See you soon. Cheers. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.